Yeah, I'm really happy to be here. I haven't been at Perimeter since I was an undergrad as an experimentalist, and so look how far I've come. Yeah, so today I'm going to tell you about some work I've done on the Kalin-Rubikoff effect. And so first I wanted to start off by sort of giving an overview of the field for the past, I guess, 40 years. So the Kalin-Rubikoff effect was a phenomenon that is essentially the scattering of some sort of massless fermion off of a monopole. And this phenomenon was studied in the early 80s by Kalin and Rubikoff. And it's what happens is that this is actually a very this ends up being a very bizarre interaction. And the reason is that these fermions can actually interact with the non-abelian degrees of freedom that are stuck inside of the monopole core. And it turns out this is actually not an exponentially suppressed effect, as you might expect from the fact that this is a very heavy object, but it is actually an order one effect. And so this is a very interesting process to study because there's nice, because it's a very concrete example of UV-IR mixing. And it's also very important for phenomenology because, well, actually, the original motivation for studying this was that in cosmological settings, or rather in the standard model, this interaction can catalyze proton decay or baryon number violation. So, good. So this was what happened in the 1980s. But there was sort of an open, always some sort of lingering open problem. And that is that this outgoing state looks like some other fermion plus a bunch of fractional fermions. And essentially, the point is that this does not make sense. And there are many reasons why this is sort of problematic. So the first is that in terms of asymptotic scattering states, this is a state that does not exist in your Hilbert space. It's outside of the Hilbert space you would get just by quantizing the free fields, which is what you have at asymptotic infinity. And because of this, there's been sort of many attempts to explain what this computation that Kalin did so long ago means. Yeah, so the
issue, if I remember right, is that that only happens when you have multiple particles in the final state, right? If you have one,
Right now, so if you send in one fermion, you always get this. It's actually 2 over n. So this is in the case where you have some sort of where you have n, say nf fermions.
You're saying you always get many because of the numbers that you have to have projects upon times 2.
Yeah.
But if I the issue about projecting onto the I think you're going to tell us about this weird the multiparticle issue, right? If I had something which only had a one fermion in the final state, would it have been that subtle?
Sorry, I think I don't quite understand your question. I'm sort of.
Supposing, I guess it maybe it's a memory question.
Oh, yeah, please.
So it's a so supposing I could have set it up so I had one particle in and one particle out.
Yeah. Oh.
Then that's the thing that led you to the fractional thing wouldn't have happened, right? It's the fact that you have had multiple particles coming out that was the issue.
That's right. Yeah, good. So good. So indeed, if you look at the quantization of these fields, as we're going to do shortly, if you just had the sort of one ingoing fermion and one outgoing fermion, you would find that there's gauge charge violation. And that's very bad. And so essentially what Kalin did is he realized that there's a bunch of non-anomalous symmetries, and that there's a unique boundary condition that preserves them. And it's the one that sends out this garbled mess. And so that's what we're going to talk about today. And so, yeah. So essentially, there were sort of three proposals, three general types of proposals about how to interpret this. So the first was by Kalin. And he suggested that maybe this is some sort of density matrix state, so some sort of mixed state. But you would immediately see a problem with this, is that I told you need this in order to have a gauge invariant interaction, which would say that you only have gauge invariance modulo classical probability. So that's essentially people don't talk about that anymore. The other one is that just there exists non-perturbative sectors of your Hilbert space. And so essentially the claim is that, oh, this is fine. This is just a weird thing that happens when you have monopoles, because these are non-perturbative. So maybe it's fine that you have these extra non-perturbative states in your Hilbert space. But that sort of goes against the sort of fundamental analysis that was done, was that everything you can do is semi-classical. So if you postulate there are these non-perturbative states, you sort of left your semi-classical approximation. And so that's also sort of a problem. And the other one is that there are sort of extra interactions that were neglected. And essentially there is, until very recently, there was only pure speculation. And the reason why people were speculating this is that this computation is based on just restricting to the zero angular momentum mode. And so that says that this fermion is a zero angular momentum fermion. And then Kellen showed that if these are all zero angular momentum states, then you must have something that looks like this. But this is a multi-particle state, so you might say, well, this is actually just part of something that's purified by the higher angular momentum modes. there's some speculation that maybe there's some mixing between different angular momentum modes, although there was no proposed mechanism to do that. And so today, I'm going to tell you about a proposal that there are some that involves extra interactions. And in order to do this, so this is essentially what it's going to boil down to. But our analysis is going to be different from the original analysis because we're going to use massive fermions. And so the reason why people did not do massive fermions at first is because, well, one, you have fewer symmetries. Two, when you actually try to do this analysis, it's much messier just because solving the massive Dirac equation is harder than solving the massless Dirac equation. Today I want to look at massive fermions because, well, first of all, they're more important for phenomenology than massless fermions. And second, the mass of the fermions actually provides an IR regulator. And so I'm actually going to claim to you that this IR regulator is very important for understanding the Kalandrup-Volkoff effect. Okay. Yes, please.
Is the thing that you're aiming towards aimed specifically at monopole? If I had a dion and so, you know, SU2 goes to U1 breaking theory, so some sort of really minimal thing.
Yes.
Where I can have this kind of one particle, one particle, right? Mm-hmm. But the things you're going to say apply to that?
Yes. Yeah. Actually, that's the place where I want to live. Is I want to live in an SU2 with some number of fundamental fermions, because it's much simpler. When you do the SU5 gut theory, which is actually what I studied in these first two papers, the story is much more complicated because, so I want to use spherical symmetry for everything. In an SU2 gauge theory, there's a unique spherically symmetric monopole, which is the minimal one that we all like to write down. But for the other ones, it's much more complicated. You have to do some extra twist in the gauge symmetry group. So, yeah. But I think everything I'm going to say can be applied to that scenario. It's just more complicated. OK. So as I was saying, we're going to take a 4D SU2 gauge theory. I'm going to write the gauge group always with some lowercase g here. And I'm going to add two NF fermion doublets, which I'm going to write as psi. And I'm also going to add a single scalar field in the adjoint representation. And I'm going to make sure that there are no Yukawa couplings. So the only interactions that we have here are some sort of Higgs potential, which will cause the Higgs field to condense, and the gauge interactions. So along the RG flow, because of this potential we're adding, we're going to flow to a U1 gauge theory. And I'm going to give, write the bev as v. And in this along this RG flow, there will be smooth monopoles. That flow to the singular, the direct monopoles in the U1 gauge theory. So as I was saying, I'm going to want to restrict to the spherically symmetric, and I'm also going to restrict to the case of BPS monopoles, although the restriction to BPS monopoles is just to simplify analysis. And so what this means is that, as I was saying, that for SU2, there's going to be a unique minimal monopole that's spherically symmetric. And it's going to be spherically symmetric with respect to the sort of standard angular momentum generator. And it's going to be shifted by T, which generate the SU2 gauge group. So we can explicitly write down the monopole connection. It's going to look like this. So you have this sort of, and this is in a singular gauge. So you have the direct monopole embedded along the Cartan, which is what we're going to break to in the IR. And then you have this component, which is off-diagonal. Or we sum over these plus and minus signs. And then there's also a Higgs field or profile, which looks like V times T3 function H of R. So just because I'm going to use this again later, I'm going to refer to these as W plus omega plus and minus. Good. And so these functions here, MR and H of R, go to 0 and go to 1 minus 1 over R exponentially fast. And so in this notation, I'm going to say that M sub W, which is the mass of the non-abelian gauge boson, which is also what I'll also call the W boson, is just V over the gauge coupling G. Okay, so because of this, what happens is that the monopole connection goes to the Dirac monopole, as I promised over here. Okay, so in order to understand how the fermions interact with the monopole, we need to understand what the degrees of freedom are of this monopole. And so I'm going to treat it as being very heavy. So I'm going to say it's at a fixed position. And good. So the IR modes in this background are going to be the photon. And then you're also actually going to find that there is some charge scalar field, which is fixed to the monopole core. And in terms of this connection here, it's actually going to be the phase of this off-diagonal component. And one way to see that it has to exist is that unless you introduce this mode here, this connection is not actually invariant under the IR U1 gauge group. The IR gauge group. So you have to sort of introduce this this scalar field in order to have a well-defined connection in the IR. Good. So there's actually other ways you can see that this degree of freedom has to exist, but I'm going to just say that this is how one way you can derive it from UV physics. And what's important about it is that it's actually massive in terms of in the quantum mechanical sense. And it has an action that looks like this. And so here I'm taking phi to be periodic mod 2 pi. And this is saying that it has charge 2 under the bulk IR gauge field. And so if you quantize this, you find that the Hamiltonian has this form. Where here, this coupling to the gauge field says that the momentum states generate a bulk electric charge. So what you find is that the Hilbert space is given by the angular momentum states. So good. So as I was saying, the charge end state sources a bulk electric charge 2 times n. And this is sort of what you would expect, because you can actually construct all of the dions on top of the monopole by just winding this field phi. And so essentially what you're saying is that the angular momentum mode here corresponds to the charge end dion, and it has a mass, extra mass m sub w on top of the oh, sorry, this is actually incorrect. This should be g times v, and on top of the monopole mass. So yeah, good. And so what's going to happen is that the Kalman-Rubikoff effect is going to be the interaction of phi with the fermions. Okay, so now we want to try to couple the monopole to dynamical fermions. And for now, I'm going to restrict to the case of massless fermions. And so since there's just these two degrees of freedom of the gauge field in the infrared, we can actually just do the semi-classical scattering by expanding the fermions in terms of the modes of the they're doing a mode expansion in the fixed monopole background. And so since they're spherically symmetric, since the monopole is spherically symmetric, that means we can actually expand the fermions in angular momentum modes. And so for simplicity, what we can do is we can actually just restrict to the j equals 0 state. If you're interested about the higher angular momentum states, I can talk about this at the very end. But I think there should be enough interesting stuff in just the 0 angular momentum state. Good. And so this is a consistent truncation of your theory, just because you're in a spherically symmetric background, and this scalar degree of freedom, which is also called the dion degree of freedom, is a spherically symmetric source term. So everything's spherically symmetric, so there's a consistent truncation to the 0 angular momentum state. Okay. So now, for each fermion, we can decompose it into the each fermion doublet. You can decompose it into the positive and negative charge components. And what you find is that the 0 angular momentum state has a very simple expansion. It actually is some sort of chiral fermion in effectively in two dimensions. And so minus. So, and there's one more thing I should say, is that these these spinners are actually constant, and they're polarized with respect to the radial direction. Okay, so what I'm saying here is that in the monopole background, the magnetic charge actually polarizes the fermions with respect to their electric charge. You find that the positively charged ones are spin up, and they are left moving, whereas the negatively charged fermions are spin down, and they are right moving. So what we have here is an effective 2D theory, where here R is the spatial direction, and we still have time over here. And we have the positively charged fermions that are ingoing, and we have the negatively charged fermions that are outgoing. And because of this, this clearly tells you that you have to have some sort of boundary condition that relates the chi tilde to the chi's. Otherwise, you'll have it'll be a non-unitary theory. And so there's sort of only two options. You can have chi is related to chi tilde bar. And so this would actually preserve gauge invariance because then these are both the same charge. But it would violate a flavor symmetry. So here, these fermions transform under an SU to NF symmetry. And this boundary condition would actually break it to SO to NF. So this is almost certainly the wrong thing because this SU to NF is a good symmetry of the UV.
Is that the symmetry which formulates the Yukawa terms?
Yes. Yeah, if you have a Yukawa term, you'll break this SU to NF exactly to this SO to NF. Actually, Yukawa terms are very interesting, but I'd also like to comment on that later. There'll be, I think, a totally different story physically. Good. And so the other boundary condition that you can write down is to relate chi to chi tilde, but this isn't gauge invariant. However, you do have this Dion degree of freedom, which is charged. It has charge 2, so that's actually exactly the charge difference between these two fields. So you can do something like that. And so this would preserve gauge invariance and the full SU to NF global symmetry. Good. So now we sort of get to the point of where Callan was a long time ago, is that you look at this boundary condition, and I tell you this is the correct one we're going to get. The way you can see that is by comparing the full zero mode, or the mode expansion of the doublet in the non-abelian background with this sort of IR expansion that we're doing in the direct monopole. And indeed, what you find is that it is sufficient to just consider the zero mode, where these are both constants. And what you find is that this has it's not a zero mode. It's a zero energy state. It looks like the psi 0 plus, psi 0 minus, which tells us that indeed we have to have this sort of boundary condition. Otherwise, there would be a bar. And good. So it's saying that the gauge symmetry is preserved when you send in some chi field, or rather a psi plus, a positively charged field, and then you have this negatively charged coming out. It's preserved by exciting this Dion degree of freedom. However, as I was saying over here, the theory is sort of parametrically heavy. The Dion degree of freedom is parametrically heavy. So you can't actually excite this. And so that tells you, in order to preserve gauge symmetry, you actually need to do something different. So Callan had the brilliant idea that since this is effectively a two-dimensional theory, there's no difference between fermions and bosons. So there's an equivalent bosonic description of these two-dimensional fermions on a half space. One way to do that is to just compare the currents. So for each chi A, corresponds to the current associated with the flavor symmetry just for a chi A. And so what you can do is you can write that as the derivative of some chiral scalar field. And you can similarly do the same thing for the chi tildes. So this is a plus, and this is a minus. Okay. And so what you can do is you can actually construct a boundary state that preserves the full SU2NF and the gauge symmetry. And so as I was saying, these are currents. And the way you do it is in terms of these fields H and H tilde. And so the boundary state you find is some relation between the incoming currents and the outgoing currents. So you construct a state that's annihilated by this particular combination of currents. And you find that this matrix is totally fixed by the symmetries. And it's has this diagonal component, and then is totally populated. And so this is sort of the tree level scattering effect, where I say that one chi comes in and one chi tilde comes out here. And this contribution is from the decay of the dion degree of freedom. So this is like a totally populated matrix. So for example, yeah. This is for each component, I mean, yeah. So the picture kind of looks like this. You have some psi plus a goes in, and you have a psi minus a coming out, and then you have this dion degree of freedom virtually excited, which then decays minus plus this 1 over n f, and then it's like a sum over all of the a's psi minus a bar. So this was sort of the interpretation of what it means to construct this boundary state. Right. So this is sort of the way it was interpreted, but really what's going on is you're integrating out the phi here on the boundary term, and this is actually like taking the nth root of a field. So it's not really like this. It's more like you have some product here over all of the a, and it's the 1 over n state here. And so there have been many ways of trying interpreting this, as I was saying. Sort of some of the first more plausible sounding ones is that this is some sort of vacuum fluctuation or soft radiation. Since these are massless modes, maybe something weird happens in the IR. And more recently, there's been some work by Komar Godsky and David Tong and other collaborators that says that essentially what they're saying is, you know, you can't really take the nth root of a field unless you introduce some sort of topological or some gauge symmetry, a ZNF gauge symmetry that sort of reminds you that you're not allowed to take the nth root. And so what they're doing is they say that if you have some particle that comes in, it goes out with this sort of 1 over n, and it's connected to some sort of topological line like this. OK. So now I want to talk about some sort of new developments, or rather it's sort of my proposal of a way that we can try to remedy the situation. So first I want to go back to this quantum mechanics that I nicely erased. So it's something that has a Lagrangian that looks like this. Very good. We know how to do this. It's the charged particle in a ring. And this theory has an extra term you can write down that's topological. Sorry, is it 2 pi? Phi dot minus 2 a 0. OK. Right. And so this theory has theta, which is 2 pi periodic. This is like a theta term. And you can think of it as a magnetic flux that's threading the ring. And so when you quantize this theory, you find that the canonical conjugate momentum is shifted by this theta term. And it also corresponds to changing the Hamiltonian correspondingly. So now we see that there's the shift here by theta. And what this means is that shifting theta goes to theta plus 2 pi shifts the ground state to 0 from 0 to 1. And what this means is that now the ground state sources a charge 2 in the bulk. And so this is actually just the repackaging of a very old story by Witten, which is now called the Witten effect. And the Witten effect says that if you are looking at a monopole in four-dimensional, well, I guess in our case it would be four-dimensional Maxwell theory, then you can write down this four-dimensional theta term. And what it does is it says that the monopole has an electric charge, which is theta over 2 pi times the magnetic charge. And if you actually write this term out in the monopole background, you find theta for dimensions, f wedges. You can write this as just the electric field when you integrate over the two-sphere that encloses the magnetic monopole, and then you find that this is actually the total derivative, so it becomes a boundary term on the monopole world line, which looks like exactly the term I was writing down. And so what I'm saying is that this 4d theta term induces this theta term in the quantum mechanics that we're looking at. And one way you can actually get this theta term is by integrating out fermions with a CP violating mass. So if you have some fermion mass, which looks like some m psi e to the I alpha, then what it generates is a four-dimensional theta angle, which looks like alpha. And with this, the way that this these fermions turn on this electric field is actually by changing the vacuum state of the fermions. So there's actually a vacuum charge density. Which falls off exponentially near the monopole, so that the total charge is given by this equation. And what I'm going to claim to you is that this is how the Kalman-Rubikoff effect works.
So you're saying that why is theta not zero when the mass is zero? So if you take the absolute value of the mass to be zero, shouldn't theta be zero? Because then you don't have speed violation.
Right. So this essentially only makes sense when you have mass of fermions, and then you say sort of below, at like distances that are much larger than the fermion-Compton wavelength, then there's this sort of charge density that's imparted. Right. So now, as I promised, we're going to have to deal with some massive fermions. Yes, please.
Right now, everything is massless, right?
Yes.
So
So can't you rotate at theta way?
That's right. That's why I want to look at massive fermions first. So yeah, so essentially my game plan is that we're going to talk about what happens when there's a massive fermion, and then we're going to talk about what happens in the limit where the mass goes to zero. And then it's actually going to look very weird, and so I'm not actually going to claim to have solved the Kalin-Rubikov effect, but I'm going to claim to you that when you have a mass, it makes more sense. Okay. Good. So now we're going to do massive fermions. And so I'm going to write this as m sub psi. And what this does is it's going to break the SU2NF, or I'm going to pick a mass that breaks this SU2NF flavor symmetry down to an SU-NF flavor symmetry. Although more generally, it could be an SO2-NF. OK. So again, if you do the mode expansion of the fermions, you find that it only makes sense to talk about Dirac fermions now. So let's write it as a capital psi, which is some psi plus and psi minus bar, which are combined into a single fermion. And you find that their mode expansion in the presence of the fermion, in the presence of the monopole, looks actually incredibly similar to the way it did before. You have two components. Which are ingoing and outgoing. And so usually what people used to say is that, well, you have an ingoing component, you have an outgoing component, everything's fine. There's no Kalin-Rubikov effect. But that's not true. And the reason is the associated current to both of these is positive at asymptotic infinity. So what that means is that this one is like a positively charged fermion that's ingoing, and this is like the negatively charged fermion that's outgoing. And so again, everything is the same. We still have a Kalin-Rubikov effect. And so now I'm going to actually write down some effective action for you rather than just telling you in words. So you have some sort of kinetic term for these effective 2D fermions and the cage field that's been reduced, spherically reduced. And then you have an interaction term between these fermions and the Dion degree of freedom. To somewhere. So it looks like a delta function that localizes the interaction to the boundary. And then you have something that looks like chi bar A, chi tilde A plus complex conjugate. OK, this is literally just times e to the I phi. So this is exactly what happens if you just plug this interaction into the UV Lagrangian, and then integrate over the two-sphere that's surrounding the monopole. And you find that this is exactly what the term you would have tried to write down in order to get the boundary term, or the boundary condition that looks like chi A is equal to e to the I phi chi tilde A. Okay. So what you can do now is you can actually do a field redefinition, absorb this phase into these two fields. And say chi goes to e to the I phi over 2 times chi, and chi tilde goes to e to the minus I phi over 2 times chi tilde. And what this does is it gets rid of this sort of interaction term, but moves it into the kinetic term. And then,
where's the interaction term coming from? I didn't get it.
So literally what we're doing is we're interpreting this phase, the Dion degree of freedom as the phase of the non-abelian, the off-diagonal component of the gauge field. Of the monopole, of the background monopole field. And then if you just plug in this explicit, well, I didn't give you exactly what these equations are, but they're in my paper. You can plug this literally into the action and then integrate over the two sphere to effectively reduce you to the two-dimensional theory, which is the radial direction and the time direction. So this is exactly the term you get where, to be fair, actually this direct delta function is just something that's exponentially suppressed but has an integral of 1, or finite integral. And so this is just when you take the limit of the W boson mass to be infinitely large, you get the Dirac delta function. So this is like some a coupling term that becomes the Dirac delta function.
So when you do this redefinition, the kinetic term is picking it up, but only at the order.
Right. So when you do this redefinition, so there's sort of two parts. So this actually only rotates away the phase, and you still have this Dirac delta function. And then.
But the thing is, pi only lives at x equals 0, right? So what's your transformation rule as a function?
Yeah, so I'm just saying that I'm literally just multiplying it as a function. But since your coordinates are only defined on the half plane, this delta function actually cancels against that fact. And then so you just have some sort of non-local time-dependent field. It looks very strange, but it actually ends up being very nice because the interaction now actually just becomes a boundary term.
But just to make sure I understand, if I write over that what the transformation was, I take psi of x for ax, mm-hmm. and it transforms to psi of x times the same common e to the I phi for all x.
Yes, that's right, yeah. Yeah. So. Now, if we bosonize the fields exactly as we did before, there's actually a very nice description. So I'm going to combine these two to find some field HA, lowercase HA, which is H plus H tilde. Okay.
In the masses of the kernels came in your integration there that you're not showing us.
Right. So the masses show up in this sort of, essentially, these are massive 2D fermions.
Okay.
Okay. I'm going to write the effective action in terms of the bosonic fields over here, so that it's easier for everyone to see. So if you do this field redefinition, and I'm going to define some master field H, which is the sum over all of these HAs, then you get an effective action, which is very simple. So this combination is gauge invariant, so you have some sort of neutral scalar field. This M and then you have a coupling, which of the field H to the gauge field, which looks like this. And you have a kinetic term. Well, I guess I can just do this. Sorry. And now then you have the quantum mechanical degrees of freedom. And now you have this coupling to the scalar, to the Dayan degree of freedom. Sorry. And so this coupling looks exactly like a theta term, or rather, it is exactly a theta term. And the way you get this is from the fact that I actually redefined the standard coupling. So the standard way you couple these scalar fields to the gauge field is like this. Like this. But you can integrate it by parts, and that's how you get this boundary term. And so. Is there what? Sorry.
Supposing you did not bosonize the fermions, is there a similar way of saying where you get the phi dot term?
You do get a phi dot term, but it doesn't look like this. I think it's using the bosonic description is very important in order to see this effect.
What does it look like?
You get something that's just, it's sort of like a shift in the kinetic term. Usually you'd write something like chi d plus minus ia zero, ia plus. And then when you have the coupling here, you get something like minus phi dot over 2 times something that looks like a Heaviside theta function in R. Yeah, so it's very unclear I think the physics is much clearer in this bosonic situation than in this fermionic situation. And so now we're sort of almost to the end. Oh yes, please.
Psi squared like multiplier, like cosine.
Oh yeah, right. So when you bosonize, so essentially the mass term for a periodic, these are periodic scalar fields, essentially because.
Like it's H star or.
Oh, H A. Sorry, and there's a sum over A. Yeah, sorry. And there's also a boundary condition, which is not actually simple in terms of these h's, these lowercase h's. Something like h a is epsilon a b h tilde b. And this is sort of how you remember that you actually only have an SU NF symmetry rather than a full SU 2 NF symmetry, which is what it, or SU NF times SU NF symmetry. Anyways, okay, so now we can think about fermion scattering. And great, so essentially this is where everything comes together. In the bosonic language, fermion scattering is a scattering of H and H tilde solitons. And in particular, that the kink solitons. So what you find is that in order to scatter in one of these chi sub a's, you need ha to be a kink that goes from 0 to 2 pi. And then because of this boundary condition, you'll have some corresponding h tilde, which also goes from 0 to 2 pi. So what that leads to is an h kink, which goes by 4 pi. And if you identify the boundary value as a theta angle, say h to the boundary is like the effective theta angle, then you find that scattering leads to change in this effective theta angle by 4 pi. And there's an extra factor of 2 here relative to over here. So what this leads to is a shift in the Dion degree of freedom quantum mechanics that says doing the scattering takes you from the ground state from being the zero state to the one state. So what I'm essentially saying is that, indeed, because of this boundary condition here, the interaction of the fermions with phi does lead to gauge conservation. It's just not in the way we originally thought it was. So what's happening is, I guess I should actually say what this means in terms of 4 dimensions. So in 4 dimensions, right, we have this explicit mode computation. And the way you go back from the bosons to the fermions, which I guess I'll write over here, is you say chi A is actually e to the I h sub A. I think over, well, I'm just going to leave it in this convention. So what this means is that the h kink is actually like the phase mode of this 2D fermion. But the 2D fermion is just like the mode of the 4D fermion. So what I'm saying is that the scattering, which leads to this change in the effective theta angle, is just like the phase is a shift in the phase mode of the 4D fermion. So it's like psi goes to e to the I. You sort of have a propagating wave front of a fermion of a bulk fermion, where alpha goes from 0 to 2 pi. And this is like an axion rotation. This is effectively an axionic mode. And because these fermions are massive, this is a like physical degree of freedom, and you can really think of it as saying, well, doing the whole scattering is I rotate psi plus and psi minus, each by sort of opposite rotations. So what I'm saying in terms of scattering process is that if you send in a massive charge, it's a massive state into the monopole, you get an outgoing state, which is sort of like negatively charged. And so this is the monopole in the ground state. And you get the monopole in the charge one state, which is the same thing as saying you get some outgoing fermion plus a dion of charge plus two. And this is really just being careful about the tree level interaction of these bulk fermions with the W boson that of which phi is essentially the phase motive. And so what's happening is you can think of this axionic mode as sort of winding as it goes into the monopole and then winding the opposite direction as it leaves. And what it does is it shifts the vacuum state, the fermion vacuum state, and leaves a vacuum charge density which has a profile which is like a 1 over the size of its mass. And so this allows you to deposit electric charge onto the monopole at parametrically low energies, unlike the original analysis by Callan. And this is sort of the key in order to understanding how the scattering process works. And I want to emphasize that this process that I've proposed, actually, it's going to match Callan's analysis exactly when everything makes sense in Callan. Essentially, when in Callan's original analysis, if you just did the scattering process n times, you didn't get any fractional states because everything would be multiplied by this n.
What's the energy gap of the dion? Is that rotor that you had scale?
Right. So the mass gap, or the gap between the different modes of the dion is the W boson mass, which is like your UV scale. And so what's happening is you're sort of shifting. It's like costs very little energy to shift the
So it's not like I'm actually doing a promotion where I'm having to pay the price of that gap, you're saying?
Exactly. Instead of having to jump the gap, you just bring the gap to you. It's like gauge theory is way smarter than us. Yeah.
What do you mean by bring the gap to you? I mean, this M1, this is a more massive mode, isn't it?
Yeah, so good. So it's more like this is at theta is equal to 0, and this is at theta is equal to 2 pi.
And the two moles have the same mass.
They have the same mass. It's still the ground state. It just like it sources a bulk charge 1.
But that's a bit strange because the thing is localized on a scale that is 1 over the mass of the fermion.
Yeah.
Right. But you're saying that somehow that doesn't mean that the thing is massive.
Right. So good. So since it has this the charge is localized in this m psi, that means it requires energy on the order of m psi in order to excite this. So there's sort of no issue with conservation of energy.
Ah, it's my m psi. Yeah. Okay. You're right.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay.
So actually, if you scatter at a low enough energy, you should actually be able to form bound states here.
So what the fermion and the boson's version of it did for you was it made the theta term in your rotor reaction into a dynamical version.
Exactly. Yeah. We sort of just separated that out. And it's like we could have done that originally. I just don't think it's a standard thing to do.
One thing I realized that you did like a billion bosonization. And you have another billion.
That's.
So this is not the effective theory. I mean,
That's true. Yes, this is a feature that I'd sort of been sweeping under the rug, is that I've been doing bosonization where I just take sort of the diagonal U1s and I've just been bosonizing that. Indeed, to make sure this is all totally kosher, you'd have to do the entire full non-abelian bosonization, and I don't actually think that I'm not aware of anyone who's studied the monopoles in this way. although I could be.
WZW model.
Yes, of course, it's a WZW model. I think Zohar and your former student Diego and people have some conjecture about what that WZW model should be, but I'm not actually sure if it is known what it should be in for all cases. I think they say it should, for the example that we're looking at, I think they claim that it should be a SU2 NF level 1 WZW model. I think that's their claim.
Is this what Witten said?
Is it, maybe Witten also said that. Sorry.
Well, you have NF fermions, you get SU number of fermions at level 1.
Yes. Yeah, okay, yes, great. Yes, sorry, yes, of course. Yeah. Yes, I did not do the analysis here. I only did it in the bosonic one, or the in the abelian bosonization.
I think it will change mathematically. If you...
You think it'll change?
Writing them to the SU and F matrix.
Yeah, that is definitely possible. I think this is definitely a good question, and it should be investigated. And I think that would be a really good follow-up.
Does it matter like if your fermion is heavier than the boson?
If it's heavier than which, sorry?
M psi and MW, which one's heavier?
So here I'm working in the regime where MW is parametrically bigger than M psi.
Yeah, so what goes wrong like in the opposite
case? In the opposite case, I think you can't. Well, in the IR, you should really just flow to pure Maxwell theory. Essentially, if you had, you're right, so you could have, so it's consistent to study the regime where you scatter energy, where the mass of the monopole is much bigger than the mass of the fermion, which is much bigger than the mass of the W boson, and then you're scattering in between these two. But I think that would be a very different model because you'd have bulk W bosons that can propagate. So here we're essentially, I don't know if it's magic, but the key interaction comes from the fact that the W bosons have to live on the monopole and they can't sort of just fly off. So it's like you can't jump the gap of the different states here.
How does your electric charge balancing work? Because if you didn't change theta,
yep.
You have to take psi plus and replace it by psi minus, then the promotion that was from 0 to 1 would have given me the right charge balance, right?
Yeah, so the Dion degree of freedom has charge 2.
Yeah.
So there's a sort of a multiple of 2 when you go from the momentum state to the bulk charge.
Right, you did change theta, but now you've also changed theta, so you don't have to change the charge.
I wrote the theta. So this is like the quantum mechanical ground state, and or in the same language, it's like the theta equals 0 and the theta equals 2 pi vacuum. It's sort of redundant.
I can't read that. 0 and that was 2 pi?
Yes. Sorry.
So both of those 1 states have the same charge. It's a 0 or 2 pi in the
frame. Yeah, it's just the theta tells you which one's the ground state. Good. Okay, I'm almost done. So another important question you have to ask is this Dion stable? And or rather, what prevents it from decaying into bulk fermions and sort of leading us back to the original problem we had? And essentially the point is that the fermions in your theory couple to these symmetries. This is an F. There's the gauge symmetry and there's the flavor symmetry. But actually, the gauge symmetry gauges a ZNF of this of the flavor symmetry. And so what this means is that any interaction that carries away the charge will also have some flavor charge. And so what that means is that any interaction that would allow this dion to decay would break your flavor symmetry. So this protects the dion from decaying. Mod and F. And that's actually, this actually makes total sense. And the reason is if you had a dion with a charge, actually there's a factor of 2 in here, 2NF, then it can decay to the monopole plus the sort of symmetric sum of outgoing fermions. And this is totally allowed. And essentially, the point is that you have only an SUNF symmetric interaction. So the only way you can distribute charge is if each fermion gets one. The original analysis by Cowan sort of didn't take this into account. That's why there's this 1 over n here. So this is literally just trying to do the nth root of this process. And but what you could have is instead of having the symmetric distributions, you could say maybe it just goes into a one particular one. But essentially, this process would break the SUNF symmetry. And so it's really just not even allowed in the theory. So good. So I'm at the end now. So the conclusion is that the Kalin-Rubikoff effect has this interesting topological feature, which has to do with sort of axions and the Witten effect that I think was sort of missed in a previous analysis. And this the proposal that I have here that you deposit charge on the dion up to NF, and then the dion can decay, actually matches Kalin and Rubikoff's analysis exactly for when their outgoing state had only integer fermion number. And also, I wanted to point out that this analysis generalizes to all angular momentum states greater than 0. So this process I wrote here is actually a totally, this is not just for the 0 angular momentum state, this is for a general fermion state. And essentially what you can do is you can use the fact that the dion degree of freedom is spherically symmetric, so there's no mixing between any of the angular momentum modes. And then I also wanted to comment on the massless limit. So if you take m psi goes to 0, then you find that this charge radius goes to infinity. And so this is what I was alluding to earlier in saying that there's some sort of IR singularity. Because what you find is that when the charge radius goes to infinity, it also becomes infinitely diffuse. So you have an infinitely large charge cloud with a fixed amount of charge. And so in order to make sense of this, you really did need an IR regulator to start with. And you might be able to think of this, you might be able to understand this limit heuristically in terms of saying that your Hilbert space belongs to a family of vacuum states that corresponds to there's some sort of unique J equals 0, K equals 0 fermion mode, which is literally just 1 over R times a constant vector. And these should define a family of Hilbert spaces because these states are non-normalizable, and so we don't usually quantize them. So this may be the way that this should be interpreted, although I think it's sort of unclear still. And I think that's all I have to say for today. So thank you.
You're with the charge thing, I didn't really understand what you meant by the charge radius.
Right.
You're thinking that I prepare a statement of the vacuum polarization.
Yeah, that's right. So it's like you imagine sending in your fermion, and it's this propagating like phase rotation. And what that does is it shifts the vacuum state, and it just induces leaves behind its gauge charge in the fermion vacuum. And that just is characteristically of the size of the fermion mass.
So you set these things up in a very semi-classical way, right?
Yeah.
So there you're thinking that you could have just done a scattering and the fermionic states are simple in the sense that there's a clock basis. And so it sounds like something is going wrong with that semi-classical story to do with your phase. Can you pin down exactly what happened? Why couldn't I have treated them perturbative?
I think it is semi-classical. I mean, you're sort of just, what you're realizing is that there's some shift in the theta angle, or it effectively leads to a shift in your 2D theta angle, and also has consequently a shift in the 4D theta angle. And then you just have to interpret that correctly. But that's what's going on. So
that means it sounds like the semi-classical background is wrong. It sounds like the background wasn't changing theta somehow. If I recognize that theta is a dynamical thing, my solution should know that somehow.
Yeah, well, it is dynamical because we're dealing with massive fermions, so you can't just rotate it away.
I'm just thinking chosen your variables in life. Do a semi-classical expansion where I expand around the solution.
Yeah.
It sounds like your point is that the solution I should expand around has to know that the field that is being interpreted as theta has actually evolved. And in previous analyses, I was taking it to be constant, and that was why I had a problem with the calculation.
Yeah.
And the thing that I'm missing was that this field was evolving.
Yeah, and I think it has to do with your question. Essentially, everyone used to write this interaction down. And then this is a theta function now. Essentially, you're doing so this phase rotation here should have a theta function. It should be like a theta function times this phase, because everything's in the half space. So when the derivative hits the theta function, it kills this delta function, and then the time derivative brings down the phi dot.
The funny thing with that is that if I took your bosonic thing and said, what would be the fermionic version of it? It would have been the same with the delta function, right? Because you've got like the fermionic version of your phi dot h action would have been phi dot chi bar chi at x equals 0.
That's right. So essentially, there's just many ways you can repackage this interaction. And they all have to be equivalent. And it just happens that this is the nicest version. And it clarifies the physics of this boundary term. Yeah. Maybe a clearer way to see it is that if you just started here, didn't do any field redefinition, and then you plugged in the fact that this is a derivative of the bosonic field, then you could always integrate it by parts.
What I would like to do there is I just do the rotation at x power equals 0, because that's where you got that interaction. And then I would only pick up something at x equals 0 and then leaving a delta function.
Yeah, sorry. What I meant to say is that this would give you like h dot on the boundary, and then you can sort of put the derivative over to the other side, and you bring down phi dot here, and then it would act like that's maybe another more direct way to get this interaction.
You're saying when the words are over though, that's not a delta. That fermionic thing is not localized at zero.
Yeah, that's right. But essentially, that's because of a bunch of gymnastics, field redefinition gymnastics.
So we've got some questions already, so maybe let's thank Danny and